Case 96 from the Book of Serenity. Zhui Feng's Disagreement. Zhui Feng worked as an attendant of Shi Shuang. When Shi Shuang passed away, the community wanted to invite the first ranked monk in the hall to succeed to the abbacy. Zhui Feng did not agree. He said, "Wait until I have questioned him. If he understands our late teacher's meaning, I'll serve him like our late teacher." Then he asked the chief monk. The late teacher said, "Cease, desist. Spend 10,000 years in one thought. Be cold ashes, dead trees. Be a censer in an ancient shrine. Be a strip of pure white silk. Now tell me, which side does this illustrate?" The chief monk said, "It illustrates the matter of absolute oneness." Zhui Feng said, "Then you still don't understand the late teacher's meaning." The chief monk said, "You don't agree with me? Set up some incense." The chief monk then lit the incense and said, "If I don't understand the late teacher's meaning, then I won't be able to pass away while this incense is still burning." So saying, he sat down and died. Zhui Feng then caressed his shoulder and said, "As far as dying seated or standing is concerned, you're not lacking. But as for our late teacher's meaning, you still haven't even dreamed of seeing it." And Hengzhi's verse. The school of Shi Shuang was personally transmitted to Zhui Feng. Passing away in incense smoke, the true bloodline cannot go through. The crane nesting on the moon has a 1,000-year dream. The man in the snowy room is deluded by the achievement of oneness. Cutting off the 10 directions still gets a failing mark. Quietly move a step and behold an ambulance going by. Or a flying dragon. So this morning, moved by the head monk. Of course, each one of us will have to sit down and die at some point. We will have to accomplish this great stepping aside. This is a certainty. We will all lose our life. And the invitation of practice is to give our lives away prematurely. We grasp so tightly to this most painful construction we call me. We defend it at all costs. We keep shoring it up. We keep patching this garment of the self. We keep trying to improve it. We keep trying to make it complete. And this this feeling of incompleteness, this feeling of a dissatisfaction, it is on one level we can say it is a delusion, and we say this over and over. You are already just fine. You are already at home. What you have been searching for since you drew your first breath is right here. This is true, and so we could then say that, well, this feeling of lack then is the problem. All I have to do is get rid of this feeling of lack. We might, in our various ways, come up with a strategy. I am complete. I am complete. I am complete. I am complete. And try to drive the bad thoughts out and welcome the good thoughts. But then we get in the business. Well, is this a good thought or is this a bad thought? Well, I thought it was a good thought, but then it's changed. So we go. And the wonderful Shohaku Okamura reading, his first line, that delusion is not something that we replace with enlightenment. So this delusion of the separate self, this feeling in our heart, the Buddha called dukkha. Sometimes it is so great, like a great wave crashing over our head. Other times, the most subtle sense of dissatisfaction, dis-ease. The Buddha proclaimed is not the first unfortunate truth. It's not as if he said, so if only we didn't have this, we'd be cool. This is the first noble truth. This astonishing human being who walked the earth so long ago, and who, of course, walks the earth in your footsteps. We wonder, where are the footsteps of the Buddha? I've looked everywhere. Where could they be? And we are encouraged to look here, under the soles of our feet. Oh, oh my goodness. But his teaching, this great man, this man who so courageous, this man who gave up everything. He left his life before he had to. All of us here today have left our life for this week. As we say, we are all monks and nuns. We are living the dream. The dream of Sesshin. The dream of giving our whole life, of holding nothing back. And this is required. To give up everything we have. And we've talked in some of our Dharma dialogues about this place where, of course, fear arises when I think about giving up who I am. I don't like it. I am quite attached to me. And this very attachment is the entry point. This is not a practice of discarding parts of ourself, which of course we would like it to be, right? I'm going to discard this. I don't like being so impatient. I think I will not do that anymore, right? Yeah, how long does that work for? These things that we would like to disown. So all of us, of course, are in favor of world peace. And why don't the Palestinians and Israelis talk with each other? God damn it. Why don't they just sit down? So here we sit down. And the different parts of us are the ones for this, the monks of the Western Hall and the monks of the Eastern Hall. Right here on this one cushion, duking it out. Oh, this is right. I'm getting it. No, you're not. You're still an idiot. No, I'm not. I'm really. Endlessly. And as human beings, our reaction, our first move is to try to get rid of the disturbance. We think somehow that peace and disturbance are two separate things. That delusion and enlightenment are two separate things. And I've got about 80 units of delusion. And I've lost about 32 units of delusion. And if I can only lose the last 38, then I'll be all right. It's not like that. This world is not as it appears. Nor is it otherwise. But here, the possibility of not closing our hearts. And this possibility of the open heart is the possibility of dying, is the necessity of dying. And there is some element of this that is not a matter, again, as Shohaku Okamura says, is not a matter of individual willpower. But it is a matter of some deep intention. It is a matter of clarifying what you truly want. Really, really want. This deep yearning that so often is a problem. Well, don't yearn for anything. You're already Buddha. That has no power for the way. To give lip service to some teaching you heard some Zen teacher say. It is of no value. So it is up to you to find the teachings that are not outside of you, that are not the doctrine of Zen. All of the sutras are merely pointing to your own heart. Thousands of koan are pointing to something that you already have. One of the things I love about Melissa, and of course there are many, many things, but one of the things is her absolute certainty that each one of us has the answer to these miserable koans. I have come to her on occasion with some problem. Her delight and her certainty that there is no problem because, of course, I already know. This is true. Of course, you already know this. And yet, without some great and courageous effort to step into our life. So the head monk, so one way of reading the koan is that he's the fall guy. He's the stooge that illustrates how wonderful we are. Oh yes, I'm like Xue Feng. Yes. I find the fools and I expose them. Yeah, and of course we know who the big fool is. Don't have to look hard to find him or her. This wholehearted commitment of the head monk, and we can say right and wrong, and we should say right, wrong. I was speaking with one of you and we were talking about the priest ceremony, and this person was saying, so this thing about falling on your butt in public, are you guys really serious about that? And I said, yes, indeed we are. If you look on the website, the official requirements for Zen priests, this is actually listed. The seriousness with which we take that, the seriousness of making mistakes, the importance of failing. Until you fail, you are lost. Until you really fail, not just a little bit, not just throw your Oreoke bowl at the person next to you, which happened to a very close friend of mine this morning. But fail about something that is utterly important to you. Realize that in spite of your best efforts, you have not succeeded in what you had hoped most to do. And that your failure is fifth day of Sesshin. I'm so moved by what I've said. But your failure is no small matter. And you are utterly brought to your knees. You see that it is indeed hopeless. You cannot accomplish this. You cannot patch this robe. This is the entry point. Without this, we're just running one more grand ego trip. I was thinking this morning of David Budbill's wonderful poem. He said, I would like to be famous so I could be humble about being famous. What good is my humility living in such obscurity? So we want to be awakened, we want the death of the ego, and we want to be there to appreciate it. Wow, I really nailed this one. And of course this is endless and impossible to do. But this clear direction, this great yearning, is not not the problem. It is not true, and it is absolutely necessary. Without something that is calling you, that is so important, there is no way to do this. In Zen, we call it rousing the way-seeking mind. That part of your heart that both yearns and knows. So we move into the yearning itself as the manifestation. We move into the construction of the mind as a manifestation. You cannot get rid of the construction of your mind. That's just another construction. So this head monk, and then this promise, the last line of the verse. Quietly move a step. This is all that is required. No great leaping buildings of a single bound. No fancy footwork. Just take one step. Thank you. So I invite you to sit comfortably, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue. Yeah, Mike.
So I've been thinking about the koan and the community, the non-sarvan.
Say a little bit louder.
Yeah, and how I would feel if I witnessed something like that. You know, with Bob and Mike committed a bloodless coup against you guys.
What? This is the first I've heard of it. Bob?
Anyway. And I also wonder about Shifu. You know, what was it that was bothering him? And what sort of clued him in to... Maybe there's something not right here. And I think it was, you know, not so much, you know, he knew that the head monk was stuck in oneness. You know, could have been stuck somewhere else. So way he could have answered differently, but still been certain of himself, feeling like he was, as David was talking about, complete. There was nothing more. He was done. He was it. And I think what Shifu was afraid of is that having someone up there, you know, leading the community that felt that they were complete wouldn't leave room for the community to really come in and be part of each other and be part of the teachers, students, and relationship. And I think that's what the community, I guess, you know, the end of the story is that they didn't turn against the Shifu. They said, oh, well, he's letting us in. And that's what happened. And that story, or the real thing happened, that's how the story ends.
David looks at me. Well, thank you, Mike. You're really demonstrating one of the things we look for in koan practice, which is to engage with the koan with a sense of wonder, like what's inside all of these people. And I love that you're looking into what's inside the community, witnessing this thing that happens, and then Jufeng, appears to have the support of the community after. Of course, this is one of those koans that, you know, probably got shaped and changed over the centuries, and his descendants tell this story. So we don't really know what happened, but it looks good to the future. So I think everything you're saying makes some sense, and I would really invite you to keep looking personally. Be Jufeng. Be the head monk. Be the community. And just see if it all makes emotional sense to you. And where it doesn't, that's where the koan point is. And you just sit with it until it resolves itself. That's the beauty of this way. It's not at all personal. And it's really personal. Thank you. Okay, Kate was going to say something.
What I'm hearing you say is sort of underlining what David said about the necessity of falling on your butt, that there has to be some room for human failing, or it's not a complete practice.
Right.
And that perhaps the community or Zhuifeng.
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 Sticking up for my people here.
Recognize that this clinging to oneness, and in fact the head monk's very actions, he didn't allow himself to have human failings. You know, it wasn't okay for him to say, I'm not so sure, I don't know. So that's what I'm hearing you say, and that's why I threw my bowls at David.
Great demonstration.
One Mike and then Harry, then Todd.
Can you see them?
Yeah.
So I also have really felt kind of resonance with the head monk in listening to this story again and again. And I think that it's probably the case for many of us that I'll just speak for myself. I come often with a secret practice, Bob. My secret practice is often to, in some way, not exist. It is to take the mind that troubles me and be rid of it. This head monk has succeeded in doing exactly what I often come here to do. Fortunately, I do fail. But the failing doesn't feel good. When you're failing in another way, like at caring for someone, saving somebody, something that really matters to you, and your heart is really broken, those are the moments when the idea of failure is not appealing. So to be the head monk sounds pretty good in that moment. So I think there's just a way that, for me, I know we've kind of been poking fun at the head monk, but I think he just really calls forth, evokes for me something that's very, very, what draws us in here in the first place? Many of us are here because we want to be the head monk. You know, we want to put all this stuff to rest. So I just want to say how much I resonate with the head monk, how much I appreciate him as a character. And also, I guess for me, the idea that, thank goodness we do fail at that. All the energy of our lives comes from those places that we can't put it to rest.
I appreciate you. So we can praise failure, and then we might think, oh boy, can't wait till I fail. But to point out that the real failure is not sweet and nice and spiritual. It is devastating. Yeah. And such a blessing that we fail again and again.
And for me, that moment when Zhu Feng. caresses the shoulder of the head monk. And, you know, another way to look at koans is that they're kind of like dreams. Everyone is us. So when David was talking about the monks of the Western Eastern Hall, you know, I hear it in your voice, Mike. You can see yourself doing that secret practice of just not wanting to exist and dissolve into nothingness. Whoa, wouldn't that be great? And then the part of you that goes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, that sees the failure, sees mm-hmm. the impossibility of that with so much love, mm-hmm. so much connection. Mm-hmm. And that's the wholeness. Mm-hmm. You don't have to get rid of the part that wants to disappear.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Embrace the head monk.
Embrace the head monk.
Yeah. That'll be in a boundless way. Embrace the head monk. A stick of incense on the back.
Or not.
Or not. Harry, then Todd.
I'd like to call him Jewish Fung.
Jewish Fung.
More politically correct. For my people. Anyway. What I was thinking about with the with this koan is that the phrase, the history is told by the victors. We know Zhu Feng's story because, you know, essentially he won. But for me, what I've gotten out of this sesshin, and it hasn't been a lot, I'll tell you. lack of sleep, lack of everything, that's all it is. Anyways, is I came here with the idea that, yeah, I know it's not going to be what I expect, but there are parameters. It's very far from what I expected. Maybe the head monk was wrong, and maybe Zhu Feng is wrong, too. And, you know, for me, what I'm experiencing is, it's very scary to think. I'm confident that tomorrow the sun is going to come up. I'm confident that some construct of the sense of me is correct. But what if really what Zen is pointing to is that even the things that are encoded in our DNA that tell us how to understand and make sense of the world quite possibly incorrect as well. And the concrete that appears to be concrete to us, otherwise we would not have moved from the plains of Africa, we would not have drawn on caves, we would not have come up with written words and been able to pass it down. At the same time, that concrete, the foundation, that hard foundation, in reality may not actually be true. So for me, the koan is about the head monk is wrong and Zhu Feng is wrong and the Sangha was wrong for assuming so much. And ultimately also for me, I wonder if I even understood the koan, because he said that he would die once the incense was done burning. We don't know how long that incense was burning for. What if it burned for another 50 years? And then he passed away. Who knows? And it's that kind of unsureness that is very frightening and makes me run back to, I am never coming back to sesshin. This better work. There better be good results by the time I leave here. So that's what I took from the call.
And as a great master in another koan says, wrong. and really beautifully. And examining this matter of wrong, this matter of two wrongs, this matter of three wrongs, this matter of this life that is so manifestly wrong. This is the good stuff.
So, Todd?
Yes, I just want to make sure I understand Zhupong's question. So, Zhupong quotes the teacher that had passed on and says to the head abbot, which side does this illustrate? So, I'm beginning again. What does that question, which side of what? What does that question mean?
So the reference point on this is one of the things we talk about all the time, about the relative and the absolute.
Okay.
Right? So form and emptiness. And so in some ways our koans are all playing, and our whole life is playing with these two that appear separate, but there is the assertion or the teaching that they're not. So that's the reference point for some of this. Is that helpful?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that I was on the right track.
And if the head monk had given the other answer, Zhufeng still would have said, "You haven't even dreamed of our late master's meaning."
So is that clear, Taco?
it's good enough to be getting on.
Yeah. Aaron and then Paul.
So I guess for me, a lot of times, koan work is just reflecting on the feelings that I have around hearing the koan or reading it. And, you know, I guess on the first day, it's like case 96, and it's just utter despair. It's 95. You know, just an infinite number of possible koans that we could spend a week on. And, you know, it is. It's constantly confronting this fear or despair. Oh, God, here's another one where I get to play the fool. But it's interesting how, after several days, you know, I don't feel that way about this call. But, I, you know, is that just a delusion? To have ease from that. The suffering of despair.
So if I was close enough, I'd whack you with my stick, Aaron, as the response to your question.
Not me, Aaron.
What would you do?
Come up here a little closer. But you know, when you were talking, I just so loved the way you went into working with koans. You really have all these feelings. Also, you learn to trust them and see that they're your guidance into the koans. Not necessarily, to favor emotion over everything else, but there's something underneath emotion, underneath thoughts, underneath even physical sensations that we're all learning to trust here, something that doesn't fit those categories. And as you were talking, I was thinking, so your description of working with koans, so here's another one, and I'm going to play the fool again, is kind of the way I feel every morning with my life. And that's, I think, an important analogy to make, because maybe you don't feel that with other situations in your life, but boy, you know, it's kind of like, now what for me? Now what? And then, you know, talk about this mistake thing. Being humiliated over and over and over again. That's what Shinryu Suzuki said a life of Zen is. And he's pointing to this, you know, that this really copping to, I don't get it, I don't know, now what, oh, I goofed. You know, and every once in a while we have a little success. But again, can we caress our own shoulder here. And Josh?
And I just want to add one additional piece onto what Melissa said. This thing we're learning to trust that is below, it is underneath thoughts or feelings or sensations. And the thing about this thing that we're learning to trust, it's not yours. And it's not you. And it's not other than that. There's a line from the Song of Drukmir of Tsunade which says, you are not it, but in truth it is you.
Thanks, Aaron.
Paul?
In some ways, I think there's already been a fair amount of voice to this, but the concept of failing, playing the fool, it resonates with me. I guess what's up for me is that just a lot of appreciation for Boundless Way, our way, our teachers and the Sangha, that when I have that sense of despair, when I have failed, that this loving caress of the Dharma is here. I guess just wanting to share that great sense of gratitude. It's very much back to this paraphrasing of Reverend Anderson's final line in our chant, that we can't do it alone, and no one can do it for us in this way, and we do it together. That's why I come back here to Sashin again and again. And I think that's it. At least for me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
The loving caress of the Dharma.
It's a cute one.
So Pierce, Maddie, Laura, and Bob.
What Paul said is the appropriate response to what I'm going to say, but I'll say it anyway. I was struck by what David said in his talk about failure and those kinds of failures that you can't make good, that are really devastating. But when I was listening to it, I was thinking, he's talking about failure in life, or failure in the world. And then I thought, what if, like the head monk, the failure is in relation to the way, to this path that we undertake, perhaps to compensate us for the disappointment of life. I mean, I think that's what brings a lot of people into this work, that we realize that life is a losing proposition. It's a one-way street. But what if the failure has to do with that? I mean, I imagine the head monkey's come to the point where he sees that the attendant of the previous teacher knows more than he does, has a greater understanding than he does. And that's devastating. You can't take it. I mean, I think that what he does is an acknowledgement of his sense of failure. So I don't know. I mean, that's what he did. I'm not going to try and be quite so dramatic. But that voice whispers to me every now and then. I hear what Harry is saying. That voice whispers to me every now and then, what if this is a losing proposition also? And I think I hear what you're saying, David. You're saying you will hear that whisper. You will certainly hear that whisper. What are you going to do about it? I will be back.
Well said.
Thank you.
And what if our Zazen is a losing proposition? What if we get to the end of the period and think, oh my God, I've just been shoring up my ego with another thing? Then the heartbreak of that. And I guarantee every one of us is practicing wrong. Getting back to this matter of right and wrong. And then it gets quite personal. And then I loved what Harry said about then it gets to be beyond the parameters. Right? I'm cool with this stuff as long as it's... I'm flexible. And I think that our practice is about beginning to see that whatever parameters we have, it is beyond that. There is no purity, there is no conception, there is no way to do this. And Pierce, like you, I will be back.
I also want to point out one thing here. We are all pretty certain that when he says you haven't even dreamed of our late master's meaning, that's an insult. That's a problem. What if it's praise?
I'll just throw out one question that I ask myself periodically and offer it to all of you, which is, what if I already knew that all my efforts in Zazen, all this coming and going to Sishin and hard work, would not net me anything? You know, that I would be a Zen loser at the end. Would I continue doing it? You know, if you know you're not going to get anything out of it, are you going to keep doing it anyway? Just a question to consider.
Mm. I'd like that on a t-shirt.
Zen loser.
Boundless way Zen.
The Zenist loser.
So, Maddie, were you going to...
I don't really have anything to say right now.
Okay, great.
Well said.
So Laura, Bob, and then Mark, we'll wrap it up.
Just appreciation for the emphasis on the take a quiet step. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes it can, in my mind, it can all seem like just way too big of an endeavor. That I can't possibly... I just can't possibly. And this take a quiet step, or take a loud raucous step, or take a step and fall, or whatever. Do any of it, right? And sometimes for me, even to take a step, there's like this glass wall between me and taking that step. And it seems like I just can't even move off the place where I'm stuck. So take that step, smash into the glass wall, right? And not be able to move, and just to hold that up as a possibility that it isn't this superhuman thing that I can feel like that. Even taking this step that I can't manage feels like it takes heroic effort to do.
Yeah.
something.
Well, so today in this koan, I was the youngest monk in the back of the hall watching this thing happen. And, you know, so I came here and I really wanted to seek the way, and I was you know, I'm exhausted and my heart is breaking, and then the guy who's the leader dies, right? And then we think we know who's going to succeed him, but then the two top guys start having a discussion, and I have no clue what they're talking about. But then one sits down and he dies. And I'm left just absolutely, my heart's open, and I have no idea what's going to happen to me or this sangha. And from that vantage point, it takes so much courage to come here and entrust ourselves to teaching, to open ourselves and then say, yes, I will come and I will show you my mind, and that's a way to liberation. This is a really scary project we're all involved in, and I'm just hoping you guys aren't going to all decide at the same time to light some incense and sit down and done.
Thanks, Bob.
But I thought you and Mike were taking over.
That's when I'm sitting closer to the front of the hall.
So, Mark, last one here.
Yeah, thank you. Just going back to the support of the Sangha. I woke up this morning and I was just feeling terrible, and not so much emotionally terrible, but I mean, I was because I physically just felt awful. My throat was sore and scratchy, and my body, I was kind of shaky. I just had no patience for anybody, myself included. It was just like, would you all just get out of my space, man? And I went and I saw Josh and Doku-san, and I said, Josh, I know, I'm falling apart. And I was looking for him to say, oh, I want to take a break. take that nap that you, I can tell you need it. You look like you need a nap. Go, yeah, just go. And he didn't say that. So I was just like, can't you see I'm suffering? You see how tired I am? And he said, go have some water. I was like, that's not what I want. I don't want the water, Josh. I want the nap, but I want your permission, please. And then I came back and sat, and then during the break, I took a nap, and I mean, I just blacked out, and I awoke to. Three men, but they were my roommates, obviously, shaking me gently awake, and just smiling so warmly at me, and it was just like the kindness I was looking for was just let me just I gotta just you know, and the kindness was no come back. And sit some more, you know, and that was the kindness. And it wasn't the kindness I wanted or expected, but it was the kindness I needed, and it was just so. And then I literally like jumped off of my top bunk and like ran past these guys and just kind of a little quick bow, kind of like, wah, you know, wah, wah, I gotta go back. And they just kind of just watched me fuddle around, you know, trying to get my sleep eyes out of my, you know, and it was just so nice that they were kind in a way that I didn't know that I needed. It was just really nice.
So let's continue practicing kindness.